Hey China, baby, you played too rough. You slapped 34 and all that ain't love. I gave you till Tuesday to say you're sorry, but guess what, sweetie, that ship sailed early. Don't cry on the trading floor, it's just diplomacy but hardcore. We talked to some countries, not all. Guess which empire won't get a call. We had a terror fever, turn it up some more. 50 on 34, now we're out on all four. Don't need no trade talks, we just do the math. Taking my sports, baby, feel my wrath. We got that terror fever, shaking every port. Seeking markets like it's a contact sport. Raise it high, spin that tax roulette. If you retaliate, I'll double the bet. Who's next? Oh, don't look shocked. 10% for friendship, consider it docked. We're spreading love like a steel toe boot. Global harmony in a tailored suit. Every deficit's a dagger to my pride, so I'll fix it with some duties on the side. Who needs allies when you've got the vibe? Just me, my posts, and my 4D tribe. Yeah, terror fever, truth posted loud. Dancing through the trade war, feeling proud. Markets crash, that's just the sound of greatness echoing around. And on a 4%, baby, that's how we roll. Every import tax like rock and roll. In the world tonight.
This isn't a tantrum. It's strategic performance art. We're liberating your exports for your control. And hey, if your economy collapses, that just means I'm working harder.
We've got tariff fever rising with the moon. Trade toss canceled, no reply soon. So let's all dance to the price of bread and spin these sanctions till we're dead. Want a 4%, baby, that's the deal. When feelings are facts and pain is real, we're making history one post at a time. Now hit that beat and tax the rhyme. Hit that beat and tax the rhyme.
This isn't a tantrum, it's strategic performance art. We're liberating your exports from your control. And hey, if your economy collapses, that just means I'm winning harder.
We got the terror fever rising with the moon. Trade talks canceled, no reply soon. So let's all dance to the price of bread and spin these sanctions till we're dead. 1-4%, baby, that's the deal. When feelings are facts and pain is real, we're making history one post at a time. Now hit that beat and tax the rhyme. And tax the rhyme.
You know I California scorpion who crawls across your circus floor. Just what do you think you have to guard? You know I want your loving, honey, but you're so hard.
'64, by the way. Thank you. You got my vote. Nina for president, Nina Hagen here on KCRW. And before we get back into music, I think we've probably got time for another one, maybe two. We'll see how it goes. But I know that you're also currently working on a movie. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a movie about my life so far with German filmmaker Peter Zempel. It's for the cinemas. It's with lots of my friends, with lots of music. He was on tour with me. He was at home with me while I was pregnant, and God knows who's all going to be in that wonderful documentary. And then I did a movie in Russia. I was the good witch. It's a fairy tale, The Precious Vasilisa. And I was first time in Russia in a big, big, old, ancient underground cave. I had a great time.
Is that movie out yet?
No.
The Russian one?
But I'm very photogenic, and so It's going to be nice to see all that.
You are truly photogenic. I wish the audience could see what you're wearing right now.
It's a fluorescent kind of universal outfit with lots of planets on it. I have it in different forms, shapes, and types, just as they all come.
Oh, you have like you went into the store and said, I want one in each color?
Oh, no, I found it.
Oh, you found it?
I found
you made it.
You know, by divine coincidence.
You got my vote. Nina for president, Nina Hagen here on KCRW, and before we get back into music, I think we've probably got time for another one, maybe two. We'll see how it goes. But I know that you're also currently working on a movie. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a movie about my life so far with German filmmaker Peter Zempel. It's for the cinemas. It's with lots of my friends, with lots of music. He was on tour with me. He was at home with me while I was pregnant. And God knows who's all going to be in that wonderful documentary. And then I did a movie in Russia. I was the good witch. It's a fairy tale, The Precious Vasilisa. And I was first time in Russia in a big, big, old, ancient underground cave. And I had a great time.
Is that movie out yet?
No.
The Russian one?
But I'm very photogenic, and so it's going to be nice to see all that.
You are truly photogenic. I wish the audience could see what you're wearing right now.
It's a fluorescent kind of universal outfit with lots of planets on it. I have it in different forms, shapes, and types, just as they all come.
Oh, you have, like, you went into the store and said, I want one in each color?
Oh, no, I found it.
Oh, you found it?
I found
you made it.
You know, by divine coincidence.
Thank you. Huh? Sorry, mate.
Yep. Get him up, Gene. You all right, Hawk?
What else do you want, guitar?
That's okay, I'm fine with that.
Get the other.
Right, here we go. Three, two.
Yeah.
There was something odd about the horse, but he couldn't say what. Well, there was one thing that was clearly very odd about it indeed, which is that it was standing in a college bathroom. Maybe that was all. He reached out, rather tentatively, to pat the creature on its neck. It felt normal, firm, glossy, it was in good condition. The effect of the moonlight on its coat was a little mazy, but everything looks a little odd by moonlight. The horse shook its mane a little when he touched it, but didn't seem to mind too much. After the success of patting it, Richard stroked it a few times, and scratched it gently under the jaw. Then he noticed that there was another door into the bathroom, in the far corner. He moved cautiously around the horse and approached the other door. He backed up against it, and pushed it open tentatively. It just opened into the professor's bedroom, a small room cluttered with books and shoes and a small, single bed. This room, too, had another door which opened out onto the landing again. Richard noticed that the floor of the landing was newly scuffed and scratched as the stairs had been, and these marks were consistent with the idea that the horse had somehow been pushed up the stairs. He wouldn't have liked to have had to do it himself, and would have liked to have been the horse having it done to him even less, but it was just about possible. But why? He had one last look at the horse, which had one last look back at him, and then he returned downstairs. "I agree," he said. "You have a horse in your bathroom, and I will, after all, have a little port." He poured some for himself and then some for Reg, who was quietly contemplating the fire and was in need of a refill. "Just as well I did put out 3 glasses after all," said Reg chattily. "I wondered why earlier, and now I remember. You asked if you could bring a friend, but appear not to have done so, on account of the sofa, no doubt. Never mind, these things happen. Whoa, not too much, you'll spill it." All horse-related questions left Richard's mind abruptly. "I did?" he said. "Oh yes, I remember now. You rang me back to ask me if it'd be all right, as I recall. I said I would be charmed, and fully intended to be." "I'd saw the thing up if I were you. Don't want to sacrifice your happiness to a sofa. Or maybe she decided that an evening with your old tutor would be blisteringly dull and opted for the more exhilarating course of washing her hair instead. Dear me, I know what I would have done. It's only lack of hair that forces me to pursue such a hectic social round these days." It was Richard's turn to be white-faced and staring. Yes, he had assumed that Susan would not want to come. Yes, he had said to her it would be terribly dull, but she had insisted that she wanted to come because it would be the only way she'd get to see his face for a few minutes, not bathed in the light of a computer screen. So he had agreed and arranged that he would bring her after all. Only he had completely forgotten this. He had not picked her up. He said, "Can I use your phone, please?" Chapter 9. Gordon Way lay on the ground, unclear about what to do. He was dead. There seemed little doubt about that. There was a horrific hole in his chest, but the blood that was gobbing out of it had slowed to a trickle. Otherwise, there was no movement from his chest at all, or indeed from any other part of him. He looked up, and from side to side, and it became clear to him that whatever part of him it was that was moving, it wasn't any part of his body. The mist rolled slowly over him, and explained nothing. At a few feet distant from him, his shotgun lay smoking quietly in the grass. He continued to lie there, like someone lying awake at 4 o'clock in the morning, unable to put their mind at rest, but unable to find anything to do with it. He realized that he had just had something of a shock, which might account for his inability to think clearly, but didn't account for his ability actually to think at all. In the great debate that has raged for centuries about what, if anything, happens to you after death, be it heaven, hell, purgatory, or extinction, one thing has never been in doubt: that you would at least know the answer when you were dead. Gordon Way was dead, but he simply hadn't the faintest idea what he was meant to do about it. It wasn't a situation he had encountered before. He sat up. The body that sat up seemed as real to him as the body that still lay slowly cooling on the ground, giving up its blood heat in wraiths of steam that mingled with the mist of the chill night air. Experimenting a bit further, he tried standing up, slowly, wonderingly, and wobblingly. The ground seemed to give him support, it took his weight, but then, of course, he appeared to have no weight that needed to be taken. When he bent to touch the ground, he could feel nothing save a kind of distant, rubbery resistance, like the sensation you get if you try and pick something up when your arm has gone dead. His arm had gone dead, his legs too, and his other arm, and all his torso, and his head. His body was dead. He could not say why his mind was not. He stood in a kind of frozen, sleepless horror while the mist curled slowly through him. He looked back down at the him, the ghastly, astonished-looking him thing, lying still and mangled on the ground, and his flesh wanted to creep. Or rather, he wanted flesh that could creep. He wanted flesh, he wanted body. He had none. A sudden cry of horror escaped from his mouth, but was nothing and went nowhere. He shook and felt nothing. Music and a pool of light seeped from his car. He walked towards it. He tried to walk sturdily, but it was a faint and feeble kind of walking, uncertain and, well, insubstantial. The ground felt frail beneath his feet. The door of the car was still open on the driver's side, as he had left it when he had leapt out to deal with the boot lid, thinking he'd only be 2 seconds. That was all of 2 minutes ago now, when he'd been alive. When he'd been a person. When he'd thought he was going to be leaping straight back in and driving off. 2 minutes and a lifetime ago. This was insane, wasn't it? He thought suddenly. He walked around the door and bent down to peer into the external rear-view mirror. He looked exactly like himself, albeit like himself after he'd had a terrible fright, which was to be expected. But that was him, that was normal. This must be something he was imagining. Some horrible kind of a waking dream. He had a sudden thought and tried breathing on the rear-view mirror. Nothing, not a single droplet formed. That would satisfy a doctor, that was what they always did on television. If no mist formed on the mirror, there was no breath. Perhaps, he thought anxiously to himself, perhaps it was something to do with having heated wing mirrors. Didn't this car have heated wing mirrors? Hadn't the salesman gone on and on about heated this, electric that, and servo-assisted the other? Maybe they were digital wing mirrors. That was it, digital, heated, servo-assisted, computer-controlled, breath-resistant wing mirrors. He was, he realised, thinking complete nonsense. He turned slowly and gazed again in apprehension at the body lying on the ground behind him with half its chest blown away. That would certainly satisfy a doctor. The sight would be appalling enough if it was somebody else's body, but his own. He was dead. 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 He tried to make the word toll dramatically in his mind, but it wouldn't. He was not a film soundtrack. He was just dead. Peering at his body in appalled fascination, he gradually became distressed by the expression of asinine stupidity on its face. It was perfectly understandable, of course. It was just such an expression as somebody who was in the middle of being shot with his own shotgun by somebody who had been hiding in the boot of his car might be expected to wear, but he nevertheless disliked the idea that anyone might find him looking like that. He knelt down beside it in the hope of being able to rearrange his features into some semblance of dignity, or at least basic intelligence. It proved to be almost impossibly difficult. He tried to knead the skin, the sickeningly familiar skin, but somehow he couldn't seem to get a proper grip on it, or on anything. It was like trying to model plasticine when your arm has gone to sleep, except that instead of his grip slipping off the model, it would slip through it. In this case, his hand slipped through his face. Nauseated horror and rage swept through him at his sheer bloody blasted impotence, and he was suddenly startled to find himself throttling and shaking his own dead body with a firm and furious grip. He staggered back in amazed shock. All he had managed to do was to add to the inanely stupefied look of the corpse a twisted-up mouth and a squint, and bruises flowering on its neck. He started to sob, and this time sound seemed to come, a strange howling from deep within whatever this thing he had become was. Clutching his hands to his face, he staggered backwards, retreated to his car, and flung himself into the seat. The seat received him in a loose and distant kind of way, like an aunt who disapproves of the last 15 years of your life and will therefore furnish you with a basic sherry but refuses to catch your eye. Could he get himself to a doctor? To avoid facing the absurdity of the idea, he grappled violently with the steering wheel, but his hands slipped through it. He tried to wrestle with the automatic transmission shift and ended up thumping it in rage, but not being able properly to grasp or push it. The stereo was still playing light orchestral music into the telephone, which had been lying on the passenger seat listening patiently all this time. He stared at it, and realised with a growing fever of excitement that he was still connected to Susan's telephone answering machine. It was the type that would simply run and run until he hung up. He was still in contact with the world. He tried desperately to pick up the receiver, fumbled, let it slip, and was in the end reduced to bending himself down over its mouthpiece. "Susan!" he cried into it, his voice a hoarse and distant wail on the wind. "Susan, help me! Help me, for God's sake, Susan! I'm dead! I'm dead! I'm dead, and I don't know what to do!" He broke down again, sobbing in desperation, and tried to cling to the phone like a baby clinging to its blanket for comfort. "Help me, Susan," he cried again. "Beep," said the phone. He looked down at it again where he was cuddling it. He'd managed to push something after all. He'd managed to push the button which disconnected the call. Feverishly he attempted to grapple the thing again, but it constantly slipped through his fingers and eventually lay immobile on the seat. He could not touch it. He could not push the buttons. In rage, he flung it at the windscreen. It responded to that all right. It hit the windscreen, careered straight back through him, bounced off the seat, and then lay still on the transmission tunnel, impervious to all his further attempts to touch it. For several minutes still he sat there, his head nodding slowly, as terror began to recede into blank desolation. A couple of cars passed by, but would have noticed nothing odd. A car stopped by the wayside. Passing swiftly in the night, their headlights would probably not have picked out the body lying in the grass behind the car. They certainly would not have noticed a ghost sitting inside it, crying to himself. He didn't know how long he sat there. He was hardly aware of time passing, only that it didn't seem to pass quickly. There was little external stimulus to mark its passage. He didn't feel cold. In fact, he could almost not remember what cold meant or felt like. He just knew that it was something he would have expected to feel at this moment. Eventually, he stirred from his pathetic huddle. He would have to do something, though he didn't know what. Perhaps he should try and reach his cottage, though he didn't know what he would do when he got there. He just needed something to try for. He needed to make it through the night. Pulling himself together, he slipped out of the car, his foot and knee grazing easily through part of the doorframe. He went to look again at his body, but it wasn't there. As if the night hadn't produced enough shocks already, he started and stared at the damp depression in the grass. His body was not there. Chapter 10. Richard made the hastiest departure that politeness would allow. He said thank you very much, and what a splendid evening it had been, and that any time Reg was coming up to London, he must let him, Richard, know, and was there anything he could do to help about the horse? No? Well, all right then, if you're sure, and thank you again so much. He stood there for a moment or two after the door finally closed, pondering things. He had noticed during the short time that the light from Reg's room flooded out onto the landing of the main staircase that there were no marks on the floorboards there at all. It seemed odd that the horse should only have scuffed the floorboards inside Reg's room. Well, it all seemed very odd, full stop. But here was yet another curious fact to add to the growing pile. This was supposed to have been a relaxing evening away from work. On an impulse, he knocked on the door opposite to Reg's. It took such a long time to be answered that Richard had given up and was turning to go when at last he heard the door creak open. He had a slight shock when he saw that staring sharply up at him like a small and suspicious bird was the Don with the racing yacht keel for a nose. Sorry, said Richard abruptly, but have you seen or heard a horse coming up the staircase tonight? The man stopped his obsessive twitching of his fingers. He cocked his head slightly on one side, and then seemed to need to go on a long journey inside himself to find a voice, which when found turned out to be a thin and soft little one. He said, "That is the first thing anybody has said to me for 17 years, 3 months, and 2 days, 5 hours, 19 minutes, and 20 seconds. I've been counting." He closed the door softly again. Richard virtually ran through second court. When he reached first court, he steadied himself and slowed down to a walking pace. The chill night air was rasping in his lungs, and there was no point in running. He hadn't managed to talk to Susan because Reg's phone wasn't working, and this was another thing that he had been mysteriously coy about. That at least was susceptible of a rational explanation. He probably hadn't paid his phone bill. Richard was about to emerge out onto the street, when instead he decided to pay a quick visit to the porter's lodge, which was tucked away inside the great archway entrance into the college. It was a small hutch-like place filled with keys, messages, and a single electric bar heater. A radio nattered to itself in the background. Excuse me, he said to the large, black-suited man standing behind the counter with his arms folded. Yes, Mr. Macduff, what can I do for you? In his present state of mind, Richard would have been hard-pressed himself to remember his own name and was startled for a moment. However, college porters are legendary for their ability to perform such feats of memory, and for their tendency to show them off at the slightest provocation. Is there, said Richard, a horse anywhere in the college that you know of. I mean, you would know if there was a horse in the college, wouldn't you? The porter didn't blink. No, sir, and yes, sir. Anything else I can help you with, Mr. Macduff, sir? No, said Richard, and tapped his fingers a couple of times on the counter. No, thank you. Thank you very much for your help. Nice to see you again, Bob, he hazarded. Good night, then. He left. The porter remained perfectly still, with his arms folded, but shaking his head a very, very little bit. Here's some coffee for you, Bill, said another porter, a short, wiry one, emerging from an inner sanctum with a steaming cup. Getting a bit colder tonight? I think it is, Fred, thanks, said Bill, taking the cup. He took a sip. You can say what you like about people, they don't get any less peculiar. Fellow in here just now asking if there was a horse in the college. Oh, yes. Fred sipped at his own coffee and let the steam smart his eyes. I had a chap in here earlier, a sort of strange foreign priest. Couldn't understand a word he said at first, but he seemed happy just to stand there by the fire and listen to the news on the radio. Foreigners, eh? In the end, I told him to shoot off, standing in front of my fire like that. Suddenly he says, is that really what he must do? Shoot off? I said in my best Bogart voice, you better believe it, buddy. Really? It sounded more like Jimmy Cagney to me. No, that's my Bogart voice. This is my Jimmy Cagney voice. You better believe it, buddy. Bill frowned at him. Is that your Jimmy Cagney voice? I always thought that was your Kenneth McKellar voice. You don't listen properly, Bill. You haven't got the ear. This is Kenneth McKellar. Oh, you take the high road and I'll take the low road. Oh, I see. I was thinking of the Scottish Kenneth McKellar. So, what did this priest fella say then, Fred? Oh, he just looked at me straight in the eyes, Bill, and said in this strange sort of... Skip the accent, Fred. Just tell me what he said, if it's worth hearing. He just said he did believe me. So, not a very interesting story then, Fred. Well, maybe not. I only mentioned it because he also said that he'd left his horse in a washroom and would I see that it was all right. Chapter 11 Gordon Way drifted miserably along the dark road, or rather tried to drift. He felt that as a ghost, which is what he had to admit to himself he had become, he should be able to drift. He knew little enough about ghosts, but he felt that if you were going to be one, then there ought to be certain compensations for not having a physical body to lug around, and that among them ought to be the ability simply to drift. But no, it seemed he was going to have to walk every step of the way. His aim was to try and make it to his house. He didn't know what he would do when he got there, but even ghosts have to spend the night somewhere, and he felt that being in familiar surroundings might help. Help what? He didn't know. At least the journey gave him an objective, and he would just have to think of another one when he arrived. He trudged despondently from lamppost to lamppost, stopping at each one to look at bits of himself. He was definitely getting a bit wraith-like. At times he would fade almost to nothing, and would seem to be little more than a shadow playing in the mist, a dream of himself that could just evaporate and be gone. At other times he seemed to be almost solid and real again. Once or twice he would try leaning against a lamppost and would fall straight through it if he wasn't careful. At last, and with great reluctance, he actually began to turn his mind to what it was that had happened. Odd, that reluctance. He really didn't want to think about it. Psychologists say that the mind will often try to suppress the memory of traumatic events, and this, he thought, was probably the answer. After all, if having a strange figure jump out of the boot of your own car and shoot you dead didn't count as a traumatic experience, he'd like to know what did. He trudged on wearily. He tried to recall the figure to his mind's eye, but it was like probing a hurting tooth, and he thought of other things. Like, was his will up to date? He couldn't remember, and made a mental note to call his lawyer tomorrow, and then made another mental note that he would have to stop making mental notes like that. How would his company survive without him? He didn't like either of the possible answers to that very much. What about his obituary? There was the thought that chilled him to his bones, wherever they'd got to. Would he be able to get hold of a copy? What would it say? They'd better give him a good write-up, the bastards. Look at what he'd done. Single-handedly saved the British software industry. Huge exports, charitable contributions, research scholarships, crossing the Atlantic in a solar-powered submarine. Failed, but a good try. All sorts of things. They'd better not go digging up that Pentagon stuff again, or get his lawyer onto them. He made a mental note to call him in the morning. No. Anyway, can a dead person sue for libel? Only his lawyer would know, and he was not going to be able to call him in the morning. He knew with a sense of creeping dread that of all the things he had left behind in the land of the living, it was the telephone he was going to miss the most. And then he turned his mind determinedly back to where it didn't want to go. The figure. It seemed to him that the figure had been almost like a figure of death itself, or was that his imagination playing tricks with him? Was he dreaming that it was a cowled figure? What would any figure, whether cowled or just casually dressed, be doing in the boot of his car? At that moment, a car zipped past him on the road and disappeared off into the night, taking its oasis of light with it. He thought with longing of the warm, leather-upholstered, climate-controlled comfort of his own car, abandoned on the road behind him. And then a sudden, extraordinary thought struck him. Was there any way he could hitch a lift? Could anyone actually see him? How would anyone react if they could? Well, there was only one way to find out. He heard another car coming up in the distance behind him, and turned to face it. The twin pools of hazy lights approached through the mist, and Gordon gritted his phantom teeth and stuck his thumb out at them. The car swept by regardless. Nothing. Angrily, he made an indistinct V-sign at the receding red rear lights, and realized, looking straight through his own upraised arm, that he wasn't at his most visible at the moment. Was there perhaps some effort of will he could make to render himself more visible when he wanted to? He screwed up his eyes in concentration, then realized he would need to have his eyes open in order to judge the results. He tried again, forcing his mind as hard as he could, but the results were unsatisfactory. Though it did seem to make some kind of rudimentary glowing difference, he